Hey there, fabulous teacher. Have you been wondering how to make writing time in your classroom more effective for your students? Do you want your students to love writing time? If so, I think it's time for you and I to start transforming your writing instruction. I'm Melissa Morrison, and I have a passion for helping teachers to feel confident in teaching writing and help them grow successful writers. I've worked with numerous teachers to guide them through this transformation, and in this podcast, I bring you the practical strategies you need to make writing the best time of your day. Let's get going. There are so many things that are coming up as we're talking, but I'm going to stick with a question that I have on here. So I know that a lot of times, and this is my experience at least, and I know you guys have been in so many schools and they've all been in different stages of or different types of writing instruction is happening, right, in all these different schools. And so where I have been, it's typically not workshop model. Sometimes it's a little bit workshop model. But what I definitely notice is that teachers are feeling pressure, you know, with these expectations of what writing should look like or what their students should be doing at this grade level, or just not even being sure often as far as writing is concerned, what it should look like, especially when they are in the lower grades and they don't have the standardized testing, because in those grades, it's like the expectation is to be able to write like they have to write on the test. When they feel like students are below that expectation, I tend to feel as though teachers, because of that worry, they think more about the writing and the structure and all of that, and really push to provide guidance and support that's just going to get them there. And I'm just curious, what would you say to teachers who are dealing with this issue of that expectation of where their students should be?
Well, it's really hard, first of all. I mean, I think sometimes the expectations are external to a point that they don't match with like what is happening in the school and with the students. I think, you know, sometimes an expectation might feel developmentally inappropriate, especially at the younger grades. Like, so it's really hard. And I think one thing is that sometimes a teacher might legitimately feel like a particular expectation is like, this feels unfair to the kids. And that's legit. And at the same time, you're still, you know, as a teacher, trying to meet them. So with that said, I think, you know, one thing that comes to my mind with that is, I know you say this on this podcast all the time, Melissa, of teach the writer, not the writing. And sometimes that can sound, I think, very like up in the air and fluffy and a big ambitious goal, but not a practical piece of advice. But I do think it's pretty practical in that, let's just say the state test, the standardized test is your expectation or the goal or the thing that you're getting pressure about. Mm-hmm. On the day of that test, regardless of what you would like or what you've done, the kids are doing it themselves. Like, they are the writer. You don't know the task. You haven't been able to prepare them for that task, and you can't help them on that day. So even if your thought is like, well, the best thing I can do is to give them like lots and lots of scaffolding and prepare them in this very like particular way, the day of the test, the kids are going to do what they're going to do. And we know that what they're going to do is the thing that they feel sort of like in their bones, like that they feel most, I guess, like confident or what's their default. So the trick is to move their default, not to like produce the best piece of writing. So I do think it's a practical piece of advice as well as aspirational that we have to teach the writer, not the writing, because we're not going to be with them for most of the writing they do in their life, including starting with, you know, the state test in that school year. So I think it's helpful to think about what's the growth that I can make in this kid's default, in this kid's, like, what do they do when they sit down and pick up their pen or keyboard? Which goes back to really looking more for growth than for an absolute measure. And I think, you know, states and schools certainly pay lip service to measuring growth over final result. And sometimes it's real and sometimes it's not. But I do think that with writing, for sure, and probably other subjects too, there's just no way around it. Like, you can say that what you want is everyone achieving a certain score, but in reality, what you're always measuring is growth. Like, you have to be.
Right. Ugh, I love everything about what you just said. So yeah. Thank you.
My gosh, Katie, heavy. I think I'll keep it light and just say for me, you know, what I had to teach myself as a teacher was just to let go of my own expectations and to really be asking kids what they want for themselves as writers and what they care about saying, and really to let go of that rigid structure. And that I think sometimes that comes from like the testing pressure when you're looking at models, or you have this preconceived notion about what might be 4 or 5 paragraphs and what a paragraph looks like. But writing is so different for everyone. And I think when I, as a teacher, started to let go of that, like, well, it has to be a cheeseburger, it has to be a race, and just let kids write and try to formulate ideas, I found that my kids grew so much more, because I feel like sometimes that box stops the growth from happening. And so the expectations are the things that actually hold kids back, which is complicated and hard to navigate as a teacher. But I'm just like, just let it go and let kids be kids and let it be messy and experimental and playful, and it will happen.
Yeah. Yay.
And Coley, I think a lot of times it's those graphic organizers, it's the cheeseburger, the race, the whatever, that like have their purpose. But I think a lot of times, like, again, on a purely practical level, they backfire. Like, they just literally don't work for all the reasons you're saying. Or they work in the very, very short term of like the kid completes the assignment. But, you know, I my go-to thought with graphic organizers in general for writing is like, if it requires a photocopier, I'm going to be skeptical of it. So not to say you can't photocopy like a T-chart for a kid if that would help them or whatever, but like, if the copier was broken, could you lesson?
Right.
And the copier is always broken, right? So like, if it's a T-chart, you could. It might be more annoying, but you could tell kids, draw a line, draw another line. Even a Venn diagram, you could do that. A web, you could do that. And I don't think that's a hard and fast rule, but I do think that if the organizer gets so complicated or has so many words on it that you would really be messed up if the copier was broken, I'm at least extremely skeptical, because I've seen kids who go through like a massive organizer, they fill it all out, and then you're like, great, you've done your planning, now it's time to write your essay. And they're like, are you kidding me? I just wrote the essay on this handout. And they're not wrong. So like, you could do that and say, oh, that's the essay, like, you're done, and I just wanted you to go through this exercise to practice. Like, that could work. But the idea that like that's a planning method that writers could use to like produce something else on another piece of paper ends up feeling like you're just giving the kids who most need your support, who are maybe the most struggling writers in the group, extra like paperwork to do, which none of us like. So I do think that sometimes that like instinct to scaffold and support coming from the best possible place ends up boxing the very kids that we're most concerned about into the very smallest of boxes.
Yes.
Too, like, yeah, the copier like litmus test is so cool. I've never heard that, Katie. And just to like, if you're making the same copy for every single student in your classroom, mm-hmm. I'd say be wary, because everybody kind of plans and operates differently, you know? So what each kid needs might be a little different. So.
I love that. That's part two of my copier litmus test now.
Don't make too many.
Yes. And who wants to deal with the copier anyway? You're just going to go in there and it's going to jam, and then, you know, you're not going
to
have it.
Line, and you have to argue with people. Yep.
Yes. And I was thinking too about that, because the graphic organizer, I definitely have talked about that before on this podcast. And I, you know, you think, yes, it's always the best motive, right? You just want them to be able to get to this end game where you know, it should look like this. But I think it also inhibits them from being able to then do their own thinking, you know, so they're just so worried about filling this in or having this structure and starting with, you know, this intro or whatever it is. And that's all they're thinking about, instead of really going through the process of how do I make this happen? And so, and like Katie, when you were saying, they go and they do it on their own. And so we need to know what that is, right? We need to know what they're going to do, and we won't know what they are going to do on their own if we just give them the graphic organizer that tells them what to do.
Yeah. There's this great book called Why They Can't Write by John Warner, who's a community college professor. Coley, I know you've heard me talk about this book a lot, but I love it. Oh, Coley has it sitting right there. Yeah, Why They Can't Write.
I know no one can see this, but...
It's so great. And one of the things that I really appreciate about it is right in the introduction, he has this metaphor of learning to ride a bike. And he talks about how, like, in the olden days, like when we were all children, which is depressing to say that, but, you know, I at least learned to ride a bike with training wheels. I think a lot of us did, right? You get your training wheels, you learn to do that, and then they take the training wheels off. And now the sort of, I guess, thing to do is to give your kid a balance bike. Now I will say, we tried this with my daughter and she was like, are you kidding me? Where are the training wheels? Like, I don't want this. We're still fighting that battle at home. That said, I do understand the reason. And he's saying it's similar for riding. So the whole idea is that balance is the hard part of riding a bike, not pedaling. Like pedaling, once you know what it is, it's like pretty easy. Balancing is hard. So if kids spend a year or so riding with training wheels, they're like, I got it. I can ride a bike. I'm doing it. But they're really just doing the easy part and not practicing the hard part. If you flip that and they get good at the balancing, then adding in pedals is like no big deal. And he describes it as, you know, if you go through K-12 education, like with the hard part of writing done for you, which is the thinking, like, what is it that I'm trying to say and how do I best organize my thoughts? And you're doing the easy part, which is basically filling in the blanks on a structure that's pre-provided to an organizer. Then at some point, whether that's high school, college, or like out in the world, you're going to be like, oh, I'm supposed to write this and no one has provided me with an organizer or sentence starters or anything. What do I do? And you got practice doing the easy part, filling in like your answers, which of course can also be hard, but you never got practice with what he feels at least is the like, the meat of writing. Like writing is thinking, writing is developing ideas and then deciding how to communicate those to an audience. And if you don't practice that ever, how are you going to get good at it?
Yeah, that's amazing. I've thought about the bike before and thinking about, you know, you hold on to the back, but then you let go and see how they're doing. And then you might have to reach again and then you let go and making sure that that support is only what's needed for them.
Yeah.
But I love that thinking about they have to tackle the hard part. That's what they need to do. It was making me think too about coming back to kind of this idea of expectations and teachers, you know, worrying about that part. And then thinking, okay, so let's say a teacher's like, okay, fine, I'm not going to give them a graphic organizer. I'm going to see what they can do. And then when they see what they can do, they're like, oh my gosh, they have no idea what's happening. And how am I ever going to get them to this, you know, the end result? And so my advice is it stop thinking about the end result. Like, you know what it is. That's great. You know what it should look like. But what you have to do is keep moving them. You talked about that default, right? How can we keep upping the default, I guess, if that makes sense. So what would you say to teachers in that case when they're like, oh my gosh, okay, here they are. Because I think teachers don't always know what they can do. And I think because you're thinking, well, this is where I think they should be in this grade level, you're just kind of like hoping that's where they are. And so when you actually see that that's not where many of them are, it's pretty overwhelming.
I think in a lot of ways you can lean on your colleagues and say, okay, if I teach fourth grade, let me go talk to third and second grade teachers and see what their kids' writing looks like and how are they coaching their kids? Because really you can't like skip parts of the process of learning how to write and how to think as a writer. And so if you're like, I want to try to get my fourth grader to write like the fourth grade state test kind of expectation, you have to just start back to once again, where they are kind of in this default. I like that language, Katie. And just to say, let me see what's going on with those writers. And I think those teachers can be really useful tools and resources for each other.
And as school, if you're like a school leader, I think that's one of the most powerful things that you can do with your schedule is to try to make sure there's time someplace where fourth grade and third grade and second grade can get together, or there's some kind of time and space for like, let's all bring a like representative sample of this type of writing from our grade and look at them together. And maybe it's like one teacher per grade getting together. Like there's a million ways to do it depending on the school. But I think making time and space for that is a really powerful move if you have any control over the school schedule.
Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, and I've learned that from the teachers' college, especially like looking at the work in different grades and studying it and that representational piece. But teachers really do love getting together and they hardly ever get to do it. And it really is difficult. It really is difficult for them to find the time, especially if there's shortage in the coverage and all of that. But it really is, they just love hearing from each other and they always get so many ideas from each other, you know, which is wonderful. So it's like so many things happen. Not only do you get to get a look at the different grade levels and what students are doing, but you feel better about things because you see things happening in other classrooms, and then you get to hear from your colleagues too. So yes, thank you for that, Coley.
And I think that if you do that type of work with your colleagues, you can end up developing your own kind of learning progression within the school, like lots of curricula. I mean, Units of Study has these great learning progressions that I use all the time, but also you can either start with like an existing progression and modify it for your school, or just create your own. Like, here's what we see in, you know, essay writing in second, third, fourth, fifth. And what does it look like? But also then we can kind of decide, okay, like our goal is that second graders leave second grade with this skill and third graders leave with this. Because I also think sometimes teachers get overwhelmed justifiably because they're looking at everything. They're like, I have to start from zero or wherever the kids are, which feels like it might as well be zero if they're really far from where the like your hope is. And get them in every dimension, in structure, in elaboration, in spelling, in grammar, in craft. And like, I have to get all of that to the highest possible level in just 9 minutes. Like, it is overwhelming and probably impossible. So instead, if you're like, the bare bones is that by the end of third grade, they're going to understand the structure of like idea and support. And I can confidently say that every kid has been exposed to that and has gotten as close as possible to like confidence with that. And then at the end of fourth grade, it's this, and then in fifth grade, and the specifics might vary. And of course, like you're also running up against those external standards, but I do think that clarifying, like what's the drop dead goal? What's the hill we'll die on in this grade versus what's the sort of nice to have, we'll do this for kids, but we're not going to lose sleep if they don't master it this year.
Yeah. Katie, that's so interesting, because I think this is in Cass Miner's new book where she talks about like just ZPD and zone of proximal development for kids. And also that sometimes we are kind of pushing our kids almost too far to like what might not be appropriate for the grade level or expectation. And I feel like a great example is when I work with third grade teachers, they're always like, a lot of times they're like, we just want our kids to elaborate so much more. There's no analysis here. And I think that's so lofty and so beautiful, but it's also like, I don't know, how much analysis should they be doing? You know, and I do think it's like the idea and support feels like a, you know, what's the reasonable goal for this kind of grade level? And I think that's really great conversation because sometimes we just want our kids to, you know, we almost think it kind of ends with us. And I think, Melissa, you had a whole episode about this of just like, it's a learning journey for the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, so but I love that idea of having, I think it would help teachers a lot to feel, okay, this is what we really want to make sure these students are leaving me with, or, you know, to the best of our ability. And not that all these other things aren't going to be taught, but like, okay, when I work with every genre and I'm thinking about the idea and support, like you said, or when I'm thinking about the elaboration. And of course there's all these strategies that we have to learn and know, you know, how to provide them, but having that idea. And to me in like kindergarten, it's enjoyment. Like I want them to enjoy it in first grade too. Like, I want them to enjoy it. And then, yeah, we can have some like the academic parts to writing too, but I want them to enjoy it because you've taught them the things like purpose and, you know, and authenticity. And so they feel like there's a reason for it, because I think a lot of times they get to the point where there isn't a reason for them. It's just an assignment for them to do. And so I think even looking at things like that are important when it comes to what you are expecting, you know, to give your writers before they leave you.
Yeah.
So One of the things that we had kind of talked about earlier, so I have two more questions for you. So one of them, when we were all talking off on our own, was about conventions versus composition, I guess you could say. And one of the things that was brought up about editing, well, there's a couple of things, but I know, Katie, you had mentioned something about the New York Times. So I was wondering if you could share that with us.
Yeah. So this is something that Colleen Cruz told me. She has some great books on writing out. And she was describing how, and I might get the actual number wrong, but that the New York Times, like, error rate, that like acceptable error rate, if a reporter turns in a piece of writing to their editor, is something like 8 errors per page. And if they have 8 errors per page, they're like not in any trouble, you know, they're like good, great job. And the copy editor then does that, right? The copy editor fixes those errors before it goes to print, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And that kind of blew her mind. It definitely blew my mind, because, you know, and it came in context of her saying when she first like turned her first book over to her editor, she was kind of like, well, you know, I mean, I'm pretty good with grammar. Like, I'm not going to have any, it's going to be a real easy edit. And she is great with grammar. And it still came back with like tons of markup. And I've had the same experience with professional books I've written where I'm like, oh, I know my grammar. And I do. And yet there's tons of editing. And some of it is, you know, copy editors, that's like literally their job. They know way more than any of us do. But the bigger picture in terms of student instruction made me think, if we're as adults, like really comfortable with the fact that we're not going to produce perfect writing at all times. And in fact, it's like almost an expectation that we're going to have errors, to the point that every professional writer has like editors, copy editors, proofreaders, fact checkers, then why would we expect like an 8-year-old to produce copy that is flawless, error-free? And it was just a mindset shift for me of like, oh, I think my expectations are weird. They're out of whack here. And it really shifted my thinking in terms of grammar and conventions to thinking, first of all, like if kids are not making any errors, like if they are turning in that flawless paper, that's a big red flag to me, because either somebody helped them, mm-hmm. which, you know, is fine, but like not what I'm looking, you know, I want to see what the kid can do. Or they're just not challenging themselves. They're not trying anything hard. They're just doing what they know they can be flawless at. So probably like simple sentences with easy words that they've already learned how to spell. And I don't want that. I want them to challenge themselves, to try complex sentences, to try harder words. So it's made me think more skeptically about when I see flawless papers. And it's also made me think about what's our expectation? So I think it's fine if I'm like, okay, you know, you're in fourth grade, you've learned about periods at the end of sentences or punctuation at the end of sentences for like since kindergarten. So generally I'm expecting punctuation at the ends of sentences. And if you're not using any periods, I'm going to have a problem with that. The almost the like non-negotiables. And yes, kids make sort of typos or the handwritten equivalent of typos, just like adults do. But like generally I'm going to want to see some periods there. But I also would like to see you, you know, experimenting with commas or semicolons or complex sentences and getting it wrong.
Right.
Because I want to see that. And even if I've taught it, so I would like to see growth in it, I would expect it to be wrong first before it's right. And so when we sort of assess grammar in its own like rubric category, I almost feel like it needs two categories. It needs the stuff that's like the non-negotiables, where it's like, I'm not going to read a paper that has no periods. Like, come on. But also then there's the sort of like assessing for like, are you trying interesting new grammar? Are you trying new grammar you're learning? Are you trying new sentence structures you're learning from mentor texts, whatever it is? And that I'm not going for correctness. And I think sometimes it all gets lumped together into like, is your grammar correct? Yes or no? And sometimes teachers work around a rubric like that by just not addressing the like hard grammar, the new grammar. But then that also means that you're not getting a sense of like, are they trying the new grammar, or getting credit for like putting themselves out there and being wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That just blew my mind, Katie.
I'm super passionate about grammar and convention.
Yeah, the two sections of the rubric, I think, is so powerful. And I mean, this is a little more spelling based, but it reminds me, I think Mary Aaronworth was doing a parent workshop, maybe it was for teachers, and she said something like, you know, if kids are playing it safe, they're going to say, I was tired. If they're experimenting, they're going to say, I was exhausted. But then if we take a red pen and kind of like cross it out and write the correct spelling, then kids are going to be like, I'll just use tired next time. And so it's how do you show that you're rewarding risk while also holding kids accountable for the things that you've taught before that you're like, no, we do have to have periods and, you know, capital letters at the starts of sentences and things. I think that's so powerful.
And I think it doesn't mean, I think sometimes it gets put into a black or white category of like, oh, they misspelled exhausted. And so I don't want to discourage risk. So I'm just going to like, be like, yep, that's correct. Like, you also don't want to make them think that like, yep, that's how we spell exhausted. But it's hard. Like it, you know, it might be then a decision of, as a teacher, you're looking and you're like, wow, a lot of kids in my class are really trying these hard words. And there's a few that are coming up a lot. So I'm going to teach the whole class just like for fun, have them up on the board so people can refer to them. Or maybe it's an actual pattern. Like, I think exhausted is a tricky word, but maybe it's a type of word that has like a you know, spelling pattern in it that you could decide to teach a group or the class.
Yep.
Or maybe again, it's reflected in like how you talk about it. Like, it's not just red pen, check, wrong. It's like, oh my gosh, Coley, I love that you use this word. It's such a tricky word. I love that you spelled it right. Or that you attempted to spell it. Do you want to know how to spell it? Usually the kid's like, yeah, totally. And you can tell them. And I think parents struggle with this. I know I struggle with this with my daughter because I know in kindergarten, like, I want her to be spelling words using her phonics skills, like, right? Like, I want her to be sounding out. This morning she was trying to spell the word great. She was writing, thank you for being a great teacher, to her teacher on a card. And she was like, I saw her going like, g-r-a-t, which is exactly what I want her to do. And so she spelled it g-r-a-t. Makes total sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't know silent E yet. And so I don't want to be like, yep, that's how you spell the word great. And I mean, we were late for school. I didn't comment on it this morning, but I struggle with that all the time. I'm not going to sit and correct my 5-year-old constantly. And I am thrilled that she's using her phonics knowledge, I guess all this is to say, I sympathize with teachers and parents who are trying to navigate that. But I think Coley's 100% right. Like, we can't communicate the message that like taking a risk and spelling a word wrong is bad.
Yes. And we do communicate that when we spell it correctly on their paper. You know, even in the upper grades, I would rather say, hey, what do you think about that? The spelling of that word at some point, you know, or just kind of have a conversation about it. But I mean, all of that about the risk, and I think about it in grammar and spelling in sentence writing, you know, when you think about in kindergarten, when you're worried about the punctuation, it tends to, I think, cause teachers to just want to, you know, push, not push, but like show them simple sentences and like, you know, wanting them to write simple sentences and being worried when they are writing this long sentence, but like it's not spelled right or they're missing words. And they worry about that. But to me, I would much rather see that than worry. If all you do is teach them perfect sentences and have them like, you know, respond to reading in a sentence with a sentence stem, then you're only ever going to get short, simple sentences. They're going to be afraid to do anything else. And so there has to be a bit of a balance, I think, between trying to teach that, you know, sentence writing and how you do your punctuation. But you also have to teach it within their writing. And then you also have to allow them, like Colleen was saying, to make sure you can take risks. And one of the things I thought about too with the editing and all of that, I think is so helpful to think about. But that person who's that amazing final editor who knows so much more than everybody else about it. And so you think, yeah, maybe somebody will be them someday, but they are not the ones who wrote it. Right. And so the ones who wrote it are going to get to a point where they only see so much.
Yeah.
You're not going to find all your errors. Right. So that kind of stuck out to me too.
Yeah, it's a great point that there's, you know, it's almost people have different roles in the whole process. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, we ask kids to cycle through the entire writing process, which I think makes sense. They're figuring it out, they're learning. But if you are writing a book or publishing a New York Times article, you do have a team of people that are there to kind of help you.
Right.
So thinking about that in terms mm-hmm. of the expectations we have on kids.
And I think, I mean, I heard at a Saturday reunion once or somewhere, I don't know, I remember Lucy Calkins talking about publishing and how there might be times where you do actually want to take your students' writing and really publish it in some bigger way, right? So to have it put online or something like that, and you do want it to be a little bit more edited, right? You know, and so you can help them along, but then also say, okay, you know, we want to put this out there. And so we're going to actually do a little bit of editing work with you. We're going to help you out a little bit more instead of the where most of the time you're wanting them to do it. And so there are ways to kind of, like you said, go through the real process where there's, you get to the point where there is this team and someone else is helping you to get to that final product. Wow, so many good things. Okay, so just I'll ask, what's one more thing you want to say? It could be something that's a favorite bit of advice that you share often, or just something else that you think would be helpful for listeners in terms of writing instruction.
I don't know how helpful this will be, but I will say it's one of my favorite quotes about writing, and I think maybe about teaching a little bit. It's from the author E.L. Doctorow. And the quote is, "Life is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way." And I think about that quote a lot, like whenever I'm doing anything hard, writing, teaching, whatever, is like, okay, I don't have to have everything. I don't have to know exactly how the whole year will go. I only have like the part, you know, I can make plans and have my map, but like, I might be able to only see a little bit ahead of me, but that's okay, because as I keep moving forward, more will be illuminated and I can do it.
Awesome. Yeah. That's a great one. Thank you.
Maybe I'll end with a quote too. I was toying with two in my head, but one of them, I don't know who said this, but I know that it's in the book, The Journey is Everything by Katherine Bomer. And it says, and this is paraphrased, writing is moving around the furniture in your head. And I really love this quote because it's basically saying like, it's all up there. You have all these beautiful ideas, but writing is this process of rearranging and rethinking and revision. And I think it's powerful just to say that like writing is so much like Katie saying, like this kind of journey. You don't exactly know where you're going. You don't know exactly how the room is going to look, but you have to try it out all these different ways. Mm. And I think about that a lot as a writer.
Yeah. So it's in there, right? It's all up there, but then you can like rearrange it like furniture. Like, oh yeah, that's really neat. I like that one. I'll definitely have to make sure I have all the names of the books and the authors, because so many of them were shared today. So I'll make sure I have them so I can put them in the show notes. Thank you so, so much. We'll have to have you back again. It was fun.
And that would be so fun.
This was so fun.
Yes. Thank you.
I learned so much from the
I know. I really enjoyed this.
Hey again, I am so happy to have had you listen in again today. I would like to ask a little favor. If you're enjoying the podcast, could you take a moment to go wherever it is that you listen and write a review and tell others what you find so great about these episodes? I would love to be able to share it with more teachers to help them in their writing instruction, just as hopefully I've been helping you. Thank you so much.